All right, well, let's go ahead and get started, simply because I want to get you guys out of here as fast as humanly possible.
Okay, and you're here in person the one day you actually actually license to not be here in person.
Did we send an email saying that we could?
Yeah, this is, if you want, this would not count as your superintendent's one elected. He's regretting it now. Anyway, first of all, I congratulate all of you hardy souls for actually making it. Facebook, tornado watch and play. So please, I'm serious. If there's any candy left, I'll be very disappointed. Take as much as you like with you. Number two, I'm trying to experiment. I'm going to use this instead of the other recorder because, frankly, I listened to the Zoom recording of this class and the audio sucks. It's terrible. Echo effects and muddled and you can't hear anything. So I'm hoping if I do this, it'll pick up the mics better, so I'm going to have a better luck with that. At the same time, I'm still recording audio, so you can download it if you want to for a podcast or anything else you'd like to do. So with that,
announcements very quickly. I'm going to skip a lot of stuff. I'll only do the two most sensitive ones time-wise. Wanted to remind everyone, next week, by surprising circumstance, we're going to have the General Council of France
coming on campus to talk about climate change. He's going to be here on November 7th, Wednesday, at 2 p.m. It is what was originally a requirement for a lunch session. He actually prefers to have a small session with students. So it's kind of as the climate change law class. If you're interested in climate change, you're interested in what's going on in France, from the Paris Agreement, he's very exuberant about climate change. He'd like to talk. You guys are welcome. All I ask is you let me know you're going to attend, so I can make sure I'm taking up room. Otherwise, we'll all be crowded at the same seminar.
What was that?
That's 2 o'clock Wednesday, November 7th. And it is TU2-17. All right. I know it's unfair, but just gut sense. How many of you think you might be interested in sitting on that? Wow. Really? So I have to order croissants then. and just so I'll know, so I won't be embarrassed, I'm going to speak French by chance. And you're not going?
We have class with Professor Kumar at 2:30.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
Jack is also no longer coming.
This is the ad hoc class?
Yeah.
Don't miss that. I'd love you to see the console. He would love to talk with you, but do not screw a sat in this class. It's a good class and you want to get to get read in it. So. But I'll record it. And if you guys have any questions you want me to ask on your behalf, I'm glad to do that too. The second one is on Tuesday, November 13th. We're going to have an energy seminar here on campus at 6 p.m. over at the Student Center about negative emissions technologies. Basically, the new science of sucking CO2 out of the air as a way to actually tackle climate change directly. We're going to have a flotilla researchers coming in, as well as folks from both ends of the spectrum, conservative think tankers, as well as climate activist NGOs. Idea here is looking at how it's going to affect the energy industry. The theory is that this kind of technology may actually be a very important bridge to get the past peak emissions and transitioning to a lower carbon economy. If you're interested in going, let me know, and I'll also add this free food. Anything you guys want to announce before we start diving into stuff for today?
Okay, then with that, and by the way, if anyone's online and you're having trouble hearing or you have questions, just jump right in. I think right now, Jake, it's just you right now. Though.
Okay. Tonight, we are talking about the middle stretch of CERCLA, SuperCLA. I'd like for you to each have a copy of this way to sharpen your thinking. I've also put it up on the website. This is a live complaint that I received from an attorney here in town asking whether or not I can recommend someone to handle the case if I can do it. It is a superbug case here in town. And I have a suggested counsel. If you guys know anyone who's interested up and whether to put me in touch with, let me know. If you're interested in his thoughts on it, I genuinely welcome your comments on it. My first read on this one is it's a weird case. This is not textbook super fun. It shows you things we're going to talk about in class. It's going to throw in some curveballs as well. So, sorry about that. All right. Remember what we were talking about? Superbug, surplus, the mop-up man of environmental law. It is designed to deal with historical contaminated sites. It works in a complementary fashion with RCRA. Remember the operative sentence of section 107, the one that drives the liability engine, is basically release of a hazardous substance into the environment from a facility in such a way that it causes incurable response costs that are consistent with the national contingency plan. Boom, that's it. We talked about all the draft boards built into each of those terms. You have to combine that with the things we're talking about tonight. Owners and operators, past owners and operators, transporters, and tonight's major topic of rangers. Okay, just to remind everyone, what are the two trap doors that work specifically with these two categories that tend to be the things we litigate the most? For past owners and operators, what else has to happen?
They have to have released as
well. About being recorded for posterity.
They have to have released as well.
That's right. It has to be disposal during their period of ownership. Disposal being the operative word. Transporters. What's the catch there? Chad, you can't answer since you've already answered this. Anyone else?
They have to have some role in it other than just transporting it.
What is that?
Some control.
Sorry?
Some control of where it's going.
Well, that's some, where it's going. Some plates a role in selection of the ultimate site of disposal. It doesn't have to be control. But as long as they participate in the decision, that's enough. Yes?
When you talked about for the past owners and operators, the disposal is defined as RCRA disposal.
Right, it's a part of our records.
So,
it's incorporated by the records.
Okay, so is that the like, solid waste stuff that we went through? Like, did you plan the recycling, burning, take it for the or whatever?
It all weaves together into a seamless, shining whole, the smarter web of the environment. Yes, it's RCRA to start letting incorporate each other's terms in that respect.
Okay.
Okay, this may not work, but there, may that be better? Okay, any questions about these? Because tonight we're going to talk about best foods, which focuses on these aspects of it. Once we've got that out of the way, we're going to talk about arrangers, particularly the eye towards the BNSF decision. And then joint and several and strict liability, because that is going to set the stage for your negotiation exercise next week, where you're all going to be representing parties of a Superfund settlement negotiation. And I guarantee you, strict and several and joint liability will make it a very weird experience for you, but that's part of the fun. So, any questions about this so far? Sorry, what? Lane, were you raising your hand or just scratching? Oh, it's scratching. Okay. All right, anything else? Okay. I'm going to do a small detour. And this is something to help clarify the Swiss cheese I'm sure you guys are experiencing right now reading the book. We've got this beautiful, straightforward, simple liability engine. We've got some very broad categories that sweep virtually everybody in the universe into it. But then, because it was so sweeping, Congress started doing exceptions and exemptions. How do you keep track of all those, and how do they all fit in? What I'd suggest is a nice way to keep track of them is just think of it this way. Owners, operators, and arrangers. And now, think about where those weird, random, off-the-cuff exemptions fit in, and you'll start to realize they actually have a structure to. For example, start with these one. Where would the innocent owners go? Innocent owners and purchasers, ILPs. Right. That's a pure ownership status liability. The only reason you're liable is because you had the incredible misfortune of buying contaminated property that you looked at and couldn't find contamination, and nonetheless it's there. But it's not an operator. If you operate as an innocent purchaser,
and in such a way that it adds contamination, you're screwed. And certainly if you arrange for contamination that was at the site, it only covers that basic liability. Does that make sense? All right, so with that in mind, bona fide prospective purchasers, people who buy it knowing it's contaminated. Sorry?
I think operators and owners, right?
Well, why?
Well, because often, definitely owners, because I guess you're the one that's purchasing it in good faith. Mm-hmm. I guess I was assuming that in operating it, you also were owning it, but yeah, I guess, I don't know.
No, but you're exactly right. It's in both columns. It is perfectly legit to have multiple columns for the same exemption here. But the whole point of the FPP is you can own it, but you can also operate as long as you don't take steps that make contamination worse. You notify EPA, and you cooperate with EPA, and you clean up measures associated with the site. But notice, not a ranger. BFPP does not help you if you're a ranger. Does that make sense? Okay. Lenders. The guy who owns your house, even though you don't know it because you got a loan. First, I don't know if any of you have the experience of buying a house yet. You will, hopefully soon, someday. One of the most painful things you have to do is they hand the deed of your house over to the bank and they put it in the safe. And you don't see it for 30 years because they hold it as the collateral for your loan. They technically have title to your house. At least where they share it, depending on the loan. There's an exemption for lenders who own title mainly as show an issue of ownership for lending purposes. That's it. A bank can actually make a loan to a contaminated property and not be liable as an owner. So that means lenders go under this category. But what happens when their loan's in danger because the guy running the site or the gal running the site is screwing it up? They're a bad businessman. Well, in normal circumstances, banks step in. They actually can foreclose on the loan. They can take over a facility. If the person disparks, they can take over the facility. But at that point, are their hands tied? Do they become operators? Do they do anything? That was a concern, so guess what? Lenders are under the second column, too. They can run the facility, but only within tightly defined parameters. They make it clear that the reason they run the site is to protect their financial interests. But they can't get past that. They can do a turnaround. They can do a workover. They can do things that make it more financially attractive to the prospective buyer. What they can't do is step into the shoes of the owner and run as a business on an ongoing basis for more than 6 months or so. Okay? Any others that you might want to throw up here? List that you saw in the ratings for tonight.
Teeny tiny
PRPs. Where would they go? Well,
I guess owner.
Now I'm confused. Which one? All three? How would a demicromis person? Think, what's the typical micromis person? PRP. I'll give you a clue. I've sued them before. I'll give you another clue. It was the Girl Scouts.
Okay.
It was fun. I'll come back as an example, but we sued them because they had some leftover Girl Scout cookies. And I sent them to a landfill. That was a super fun site. And I'll explain why it's just a good thing to do at the end of the day. But anyway, let's see. So would that be, would they call Scouts
like
owner
or
operator?
What's our arranger?
Yeah.
But even if you're an operator producing it to micromiss the volume, then that, I mean, that would be an exception for you too as well.
Why?
Operating can still be owner.
If I'm running a site, and that site is a big old nasty dachshund dump, but I just happen to do less than 110 gallons of my own waste when I'm running the site, and that 110 gallons minus ends up mixed in with the plutonium, am I exempt as an operator in that circumstance? Even if I didn't generate the bulk of the waste? Nope. No, and I'm hoping the hypothetical is so ridiculous it illustrates that it's actually designed to only cover you in this column. So, demicromis. But it usually is not interpreted to cover owner and operator liability. Okay, any others? Jack?
Third party acts or omissions.
Oh, where does that fit in?
All three, I think.
Okay. I'm going to potentially step off the path, so tell me if this gets a little bit wild and woolly. These are all rifle shot amendments to Superfund to solve complaints from constituents. Banks, there's a case called Fleet Factors in 11th Circuit that said they could be liable because they had the capacity, even if they never used it, to control these sites. The banking industry went bonkers. So, Congress passed an exception, lenders. Same thing with all of these. There are narrow, targeted fixes. What you're talking about is different. It's actually wired into the DNA of Superfund from the very beginning as part of 107. That third-party defenses are part of what I'll just call baseline defenses. Remember what those are? It was active third party, which we'll go into a little bit more detail in a second. What were the other two, real quickly?
Active God.
Active God. Who said that?
Main active.
Active God. Okay. And what was the last time I heard it? All right. Just two questions to think about. We could come back to the time permits, but I do want to get you out in time for trick-or-treating. Is Harvey an act of God?
Could be.
Harvey flooded every Superfund site in the Houston area. It actually caused the cap on one of them to fail and release hazardous substances into the environment. Act of God? Jack's saying it could be. Anyone else? You say yes? Anyone say no? Elena is stretching, so I'm not sure. It's an ambiguous signal.
Wasn't there a situation with the body that it wasn't in your property, so it broke, so it made the whole situation worse?
That's the site I'm talking about. The Sanderson River pits. The cap failed.
I feel like that kind of steps out of the room.
Why? You're right, legally, but why? It's there. Jack's absolutely right. It's wired in there. Active war. Here's the other question to pull in the sense for you. The Goodyear rubber plant built in the Ship Channel, along with several other refineries and other chemical plants, was built in World War II. It's part of a crash program to actually build up our rubber capacity for the military effort. The government directed the construction of that facility. Active war. Why not, Jack?
Caused solely by, right? Just like the act of God defense.
All right, the contamination all occurred prior to 1947.
I mean, I still don't think that's like a cause solely by. I mean, surely people are still profiting by this, right?
You are right, but with caveats. Some courts have actually said World War II contamination, if the government not only controlled the production, but they controlled how it was disposed, directly where it went to, and excluded part of wherever, the government can be liable in circumstances. But in the majority of cases, you're right. Active war is construed fairly narrowly. It means basically Russians taking over the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Small political comment, not caravans coming from Central America. All right. So now it gets us to the last one. Active third party, just to remind everybody, this one does have exemptions wired into it. Namely, it has to be an act of a third party that was unforeseeable, that you couldn't anticipate and take steps. So foreseeability is built into it too. If I have a site and I don't put up a fence, even though I know there are vandals around, I can't point to an active third party defense to keep me from getting liable if they come in and blow the valves on my tanks. The second, and this is the big one, contractual relationship. It doesn't count if you have a contract with a supposed third party actor. I feel like there are certain spots I can't stand in the classroom. Okay. All right. So where is that going to hurt you the most, the contract extension to the third party defense? How so?
So arranging for it to go somewhere. So we would be able to claim that they even like negligently or improperly disposed of it because you had a contractual
relationship. Excellent. If I could weed out your nightmare scenario a little further, I'm a perfectly good-hearted, good-faith dealer of the hazardous material, and I contract the transporter to take it to the safest hazardous waste facility in the universe, and he takes it and he decides to port it to a buyer. Okay. I'm sorry, I remember you.
Oh,
I
was excited.
contract relationship. But where really tends to bite people is when I make the stupid mistake of buying a piece of property and the person who owned it before me can tend the hell out of it and didn't tell me. He said, here you go. Guess what? I have a contractual relationship with them because the sales contract is a contractual relationship. Boom. That's why we have instant owner exemptions. That's why we have on by prospective purchase, because the contract exceptions just basically tubes a third party defense. Hanging together? Let me throw a few others up there that we're going to get to our two cases for tonight. Acrodev, Superfund Recycling Equity Act. There's wired in exceptions for people who recycle. I put it over here because clearly and obviously it's for arrangers who arrange for recycling, not interpreted to apply to owner operator liability. And I'll throw in one more out there. There is an exemption for municipal solid waste. This is where my Girl Scout case comes in. If it occurs after, and why they chose this date, I don't know, April Fool's Day, 2001, and that's a small amount, but it's municipal waste that's not hazardous, that comes from either a house or a small business, it's exempt. Let me explain why, and this will explain why all these had to be written into the statute. We, the companies I was working with, as part of a big collective of potentially responsible parties of this landfill, decided to sue the Girl Scouts. We could, because remember, Superfund says not only can the government sue against money back, private parties who spend money can sue too. They have private cost recovery actions. We'd spend money. We wanted to get other parties involved to help pay for the cleanup. Our theory was if we pulled in everybody who sent waste to this municipal solid waste landfill, we would do two things. Spread the cost to a whole bunch of parties so the relative shares are small, and put pressure on BPA. BPA had the Girl Scouts knocking on their door saying, what on earth is going on? Help us out. BPA would be forced to step in and help craft a more logical cleanup for the site in better terms for payout. Well, BPA didn't like that. BPA had its own guidances saying it was never going to sue these people. But that didn't stop us folks in the private sector who was obviously to get our costs back. So they had to be written into the statute. That's why we have this slowly accumulating overlay of exceptions into what's really supposed to be a clean and simple system of liability. Does that make sense for everyone?
So if you have a Girl Scout one, that's a landfill that is designated as a Superfund site, anyone that, the Girl Scout arranged or something that can be classified as a hazardous substance in a certain way, got it transported there and dumped.
Yes, with a few grace nuts folded in.
Okay.
because you know I can never run it live here without some further details. The release of a hazardous substance. What hazardous substance would Girl Scout release have? Sugar? I like that, but I don't think sugar counts as a hazardous substance. It should be.
The secret is it doesn't have a numerical threshold. Teeny tiny amounts are all it takes to count as a release.
So, if you had, for example, I've seen lawsuits, cases where paper was shipped to a landfill, and it turns out paper has trace amounts of dioxin in it, that's enough. There is no minimal amount. The only time you sort of see it pop up is a voice of reasonability is, remember, you have to have a response, a release that causes a curl response cost. If it's so small, you can't argue that faith that caused the curl response cost. Some courts will say, go away. But by and large, if they're all mixed together, joint sum of liability, it doesn't have a bottom threshold that's very high. The other part is joint sum of liability. So, they are exceptions, they're still good. Now,
so not liable.
Not liable. Now, one of those, I'm trying to remember which one, there is a DeMarcus exception that had a date that at least some disposal had to occur before April 1st, 2009. But the municipal solid waste and the Superfund recycling on the person will just straight up good.
And then after April 1st,
no liable. For MSW, after April 1st, you're good. As long as you're a house or a small business. I feel silly talking to you guys. I can't apply for two people. Sorry about this. Okay. So that's the backdrop. Remember, we finished class last Monday. And I said that there is one case that I can guarantee you will show up in the final in some shape, form, or fashion. So it's worth spending a little time talking about. That's the best foods decision. Justice Souter's contribution to environmental law. Best Foods is all about this. What's an owner and operator? And it's all about it in the context of corporate subsidiaries. So I feel like I've kind of been monologuing for a while. Anyone care to jump in? And you don't have to give the facts, the details, the corporate history, or which subsidiary bought which one at which time. Could, in simple plain English, what is the holding of Best Foods?
If the parent company actually uses the facility and operates, then they are strictly liable. If they're just acting in the parent company management, then they are not, unless the corporate fails first.
Okay, and I think you've got it, but it helped me if we could tease apart a little bit. When you say they directly operate, do you mean in the sense of that their subsidiaries directly operate?
No, as in they go in and control the actual operation and use the facility.
So they just come step subsidiary, step aside. The big boys are here.
Pretty much.
Okay. And which one of that liabilities is that owner liability or rent operator liability?
Operator liability.
Okay. So let's break them down. Corporate parent with a subsidiary that's actually on the side. Category one. Owner liability. Can the parent be liable as an owner because they own a subsidiary that owns the property?
I don't know. Probably.
How so?
If you own the subsidiary, then I'm guessing you also own what the subsidiary owns.
I own 100% of the shares, but the subsidiary holds the title and is safe on the side. Okay. Then what parent corporation will ever not be liable for Superfund for owners? Well, that's a different. Assuming we're not having any of these other backdrop events, we're talking about straight up baseline, what is liability for owner operators at this point? And good child process, but I'm going to say, if you're thinking about it, I'm going to tell you it's because you are intuitively exactly correct. It's a hard question. It's Sixth Circuit, Third Circuit, they all went in different directions, saying that corporate ownership of a subsidiary means that you were corporate owner of the facility, and just put the two in the same category. Other circuits said, hell no, that just does away with corporate law entirely. I'm sorry, Jack, what are you missing?
I was going to say, I don't think the parent company can be liable as an owner unless they appear to work with them.
All right, so this, before we get to that last two, all were clause, so they respect the corporate niceties. The fact that they own the sub doesn't mean that they are an owner of the facility.
And liability comes with the subsidiary.
Right. So if they suck the subsidiary dry, that's the risk. That's it.
Yeah.
All right. So just to make sure I understand that, the corporate niceties, just typically what does that mean? I assume some of you have had corporate law already because the bar is looming on. No? Okay. Indulgement. Things that you must do to avoid getting the veil pierced. These are important from the market law perspective because your client is in Greece if they don't do these things. You have to have basically respect for the terms of the corporate form, which means maintaining separate books, separate accounts, corporate minutes for meetings of the board. You can have interlocking officers, but the officers have to exercise their capacity for the different entities that reflect their different roles. If I am the CEO of the parent and the sub, that's cool. As long as when I'm the CEO of the sub, I am looking at the sub's interests, not the parents. And usually, the truth is, real world answer here, you have to really abuse the form for the courts to appear surveilled. This is one of the most fundamental tenets of corporate law. So, starting back, you're both right. I'm not sure this is going to be a success, guys. I'm sorry. I think it's actually a problem is staying too close to those things. Okay. Parent ownership alone is not enough unless the veil is pierced. All right. So we now have also talked about what will cause could be pierced. Disregard the form, treating the subsidiary as basically an appendage of the parent, raiding the books, taking the money, inadequately capitalizing the subsidiary. All the sort of things that just show that it's just paper, that it's not a real corporate entity. So that's box one. Now I'm going to dig into the cost correct answer. What about operator liability? That answer is owner liability. What about operator? And I think you said that that couldn't be an owner, that couldn't be an operator. If the subsidiaries acting, or I'm sorry, I've lost track.
If the parent company is acting as a management over company, then they're fine. But if they go in and use the facility as an operator, right, then they're the operator.
Step aside from the headquarters right here. Does that sound right to everybody as well, Professor? Short answer is largely yes. Certainly, the parent has screwed up if they walk in and essentially act in its own interest to override the subsidiary's operations and essentially assumes control, particularly of waste management operations. Here's where it gets really murky. This is why Souter writes such an impenetrable opinion. And I'm sorry you guys had to wait through it, but it's a vital passage for every environmental lawyer. What happens when the parent and the sub are interlocked? What happens if the parent does things that serves its interest? Those are perfectly fine because the subsidiary is basically designed to serve the interest of the parent. When do you cross that line operationally? And here's where Souter's most, here's the metaphor you will see from the beginning again. This is the one that will probably pop up when you do an analysis of your clients at some point in the future. Hats. It is perfectly permissible for the same individual to wear one hat for the parent and do the same function but wear a different hat in the subsidiary. As long as they're not taking actions wearing that subsidiary hat in such a way that it solely benefits the parent in a way that undermines the interest of the subsidiary, that effectively results in a disregard of the subsidiary's interest. In other words, I can't go down to the subsidiary and say, I am your environmental manager. By the way, I'm an environmental manager parent too, but I'm your environmental manager. I am going to strip everything from this facility and run it in such a way that protects the folks back at the home office, your employees. They have to be consonant with the parent subsidiary relationship. And that, unfortunately, is not a bright line, is it? It's pure work. It's very fact specific. You have to make that assessment every single time. And I got to tell you, of all the Supreme Court decisions, this one is probably generating as much environmental litigation as you know. Because millions, if not billions of dollars, ride on whether or not the parent is an operator as opposed to the subsidiary. We were doing a discussion of the Chevron Ecuador litigation exactly in the climate change class. Literally, $8.6 billion on the line on whether or not they can pierce the veil between the subsidiaries and the parent based on their interlocking operations. Okay?
So, with that in mind, any questions about how Best Foods operates and what you can expect from it?
As always, I have a brain teaser to leave you with. It all kind of work your way through it that you want. I'll ask the fundamental one. Where does corporate law come from? Someone said it correctly. Why?
The states.
Okay. All right. States. State law. We all know Delaware, right? Delaware is the fount of most corporate law because most states are incorporated in Delaware because they're lawsuits. All right, this is a federal statute. Do you use federal law or state law to determine whether or not to pierce the corporate veil? Does this statute federalize corporate law or supervised liability? But this is not black or this black. My answer, I'm just giving it to you to think about because it's still being actively. But it brings into highlight the way this statute intersects very uneasily.
All cool, all good? All right, because here's the last lap. I want to make sure we get two more things under our belt, and I'm pushing hard to get you guys out of here by 7.
Don't tell the dean.
All right. We've talked about owners, operators, now we're to arrangers. For arranger liability, just to make sure we're on the same page, arrange what?
The disposal.
Yep, 107A4.
Okay.
Now you're right, I want to make sure you get credit, I'll even throw you some candy, but let's go.
Disposal of the hazardous substance.
I say, well, we can't get cats out of here.
Snickers? Okay. All right. Disposal and of what? Of how? What are we talking about?
The hazardous substances.
With an arranger, they're really, this one's much broader.
accident used to, for example, one person argued that, they could be able to sue General Electric because General Electric sold transformers that had small little bits of PCB in the mineral oil that used to lubricate the engines. And guess what? They said that the transformers would eventually be discarded, and therefore GE meant and arranged for the disposal of the PCBs by selling transformers in the open market. The Third Circuit said no. But that's how broad this is interpreted to try and cover all sorts of transactions. So, with that in mind, this generated enormous amounts of litigation until the Supreme Court finally had an opinion talking about its terms, and fairly recently. So, if you don't mind, I'll get rid of these exceptions here, because this is the case, it's split in two parts. I'm still carrying both parts at the same time. What I'd like to do essentially is just really boil it down to a very ugly diagram. Remember this from the book? Rail line goes along here. Pesticide formulation over here. Large tanks, loading operations. The railroad companies own this part. This part was operated by the actual owner, actual operator of the chemical formulation facility. And just to sort of make sure we're all plugged in, because some of you may work someday for this particular entity, which was the company that was the arranger? Shell? For what? Yeah, oh well, yeah, there are actually three different chemicals, but what's the thing that Shell alleged to arrange for? They were selling it.
Yeah.
This stuff was pure commercial grade insecticide. Nasty stuff, but that's what it was meant to be. All right, so what were the arranging they have done with the pesticide here then that got them in the water, in the hot water?
Did
they do that?
For it to be put into
the storage tanks.
Schmo operated
a site with that. Schmo and the transport. And I know I'm not being facetious, but yes, keep going. So why would Shell be on the hook for that?
Because they knew that there were some incidental spills, and so whoever was sitting there said that because they knew that those incidental spills were occurring, and even though they took some type of action to mitigate it, there was still a hurricane. They knew that. That satisfied them.
So, make sure we're all clear on this, and make sure this doesn't offend anyone's sense of justice and truth. Shell was being held allegedly liable as an arranger because they told Schmo, site operator, how to prevent spills.
How to prevent spills in the end. I think Justice Ginsburg points out because they changed from using 55-gallon drums, which apparently had less incidental spillage, to using the large tanks that required going through the hoses and whatnot with that more spillage.
Indulge me. Let's simply take my word for it that she may not be talking right about 55-gallon drums not leaking. But let's leave that aside. Okay, so Shell, by conditioning the terms of sell to Joe Schmo, they end up effectively having an indirect form of control over substances they don't own. They're selling to someone else. The title's transferred at this point. Once it gets past the fence, they don't own it. But they're auditing it. They have an instruction manual. They have conditions on how it's going to be handled before they'll sell it. And it's that degree of control affecting disposal that allegedly made them an arranger. Those handling requirements implicitly built in some operational steps that almost inevitably require spillage.
If these are all pesticides, aren't pesticides accepted from the definition of release?
Only if they're applied in a maritime fashion.
Okay.
Good question. Yeah. Any others? Okay, so
my favorite question, who won?
Jack.
Shell won this one.
All right, how so?
So the distinction that the court makes is between someone who's an arranger, someone who's not, and someone who's selling a useful product versus someone who's arranging for the disposal or treatment of an otherwise non-useful product.
Why are those two distinct?
Well, so there are a lot of things, a lot of substances that are hazardous and that might fall under the definition of surplus hazardous substance. However, these may have uses and you're not arranging for these substances to be disposed or treated, you're arranging for these substances to be used in some sort of process or product. Whereas a lot of times you will arrange for some hazardous substance to literally just be disposed of or treated or, you know, sort of indirectly. So like we've been talking about.
So real world example about a test that you're reading into the ENS episode. A lot of whale tanks back in the refining process end up with crud in the bottom. That actually has to be blasted out and turned into a slurry. The bulk of this stuff is crap. That's a technical term. But they send it to a re-refining operation, it's a special operation, and they just squeak out a little less cut of usable hydrocarbon out there. And then they toss their railways. If I sell my sludge in a bottom tank, and for good money, it's worth money, it's just not worth a lot of money. And I avoid the cost of disposing this stuff that was costed. Is that arranging or not under the way you read this test?
So what I think the court says is they look to the primary purpose of the transaction. And my intuition tells me that you could point to the amount of money that you're getting from that sale and use that to say, to argue, look, it's clear that the primary purpose of this transaction is not financially motivated. But that would, I think, definitely be subject to argument on by both sides.
This is that moment that happens in occasional classes where I have to bite my tongue and tell you how that case turned out. But you put your finger on exactly the issue you had today. Yeah. I'll simply say this. The CERCLA definition of arrange is incredibly unhelpful. It's the person who arranges for your disposal. That's the definition. The circle is filled with circular definitions like that. So Justice Stevens does all he can do, what any of the judges can do. He says, what's the ordinary meaning? And the ordinary meaning of range has some degree of intentionality. What was the purpose of the range? And he's quite clear. If, you know, there's a spectrum. If it is a sale of a commercial product that has no disposal aspect to it, clearly not arranging, if it's pure waste disposal, it's that gray level in the middle. And it's fast and simple. And then you have to look at whether or not the transaction has enough initial to reflect the desire to treat or dispose as a substance as part of the commercial transaction to make it an arrangement of disposal or treatment. The classic example is the case that's mentioned in your book. I will say its name because it will pop up. It's the one that most of our lawyers know by name. The Acedo Agricultural Corporation decision. It's on the 8th Circuit. Which basically was this. There was a company that made the precursors of pesticides, and they didn't want to mix them. They didn't want to have anything with that business. So they shipped it off to a formulator who did the mixing and blending and shipped the final product back to them. Well, it turned out as you do the mixing, you have to throw away parts of the excess or contaminated parts. Turned out that according to the circuit court, that was an arrangement for disposal. That off-site blending operation, that formulation, included as an inherent and necessary element of disposal of those hazardous substances. So therefore, even though it was a valid commercial interpretive transaction, even though it was clearly not predominantly driven by a desire to get rid of waste, it had enough initiative to make it effectively an arrangement for disposal or treatment of hazardous substances. So point being, Jack, it's not binary, it can be both. But it has to have enough to really make it so it's enough to give it the quality of intentionally arranging for a part of the transaction for disposal or treatment. Okay, so I asked who won. Jack correctly said Shell. Who lost?
Railroad.
we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Who else might want to? They're bankrupt. Who's the EPA? Who's the government?
The people.
And us. Who paid to plant the spike shells here? What we're really talking about here is whether or not the resources for cleanups are coming from potentially responsible parties or from the government. This. And here, other parties that are there, at the end of the day, if Shell gets an early exit, goodbye, are the railroad companies, because everybody conceded and admitted that they were undeniably an owner of this portion of the site. Fee simple. And they also undeniably had spills of hazardous substance, both in the past around it and their current ownership. Notice who doesn't get mentioned again? The book mentions, the case mentions them. I really don't know what happened to them. Dow Chemical. I've also wanted to pull this file out of the Supreme Court doc to see how these guys mentioned that case where they didn't pay more than they thought that they were paying. But Dow Chemical is dependent too. They sort of gone. All right. So, going back to Jack's answer, why is it
Arlington Northern Santa Fe the loser of this case?
Did the railroad companies win or lose this case? Arlington Northern Santa Fe. So Arlington Northern Santa Fe, this decision was shelled out to Paul. The railroad companies owned that portion. The normal default arrangement? If you have an injury to the environment, and it's a single injury, all of these chemicals are mixed into a witch's brew in the groundwater, that is considered to be usually an indivisible harm. If you have an indivisible harm, not only will be stripped of this action, it's also joint several. We talked about this in our last class. So, if Shell walks, and it's an indivisible injury, BNSF writes the check, right? They pick up the Orpin or any kind of chair. And I counsel you to ask, did they end up being on the joint and several line? Okay. Anyone else remember?
They only get told from 9%.
Where did that magic number come from?
They made it up.
Well, when you say they made it up,
it's a court.
Yeah, the trial judge did. All right, I have to be careful at this point because I know the environmental lawyers at BNSF and so the court was not getting what they described as a scorched earth litigation. No holds barred. Here's why. Railroad companies, y'all may know this already, but when they were expanding the rail networks during the 1860s through the 1880s, and federal legislation was encouraging the building of rail lines, turned out that every rail, when they built a rail line, they also got title to the property surrounding the rail line. Some of the largest landowners in the nation are rail line companies. Better yet, they didn't just get this property, they got flares off to the side. So they ended up holding all this unrelated property and acreage off to the side. So a lot of these rail companies looked at their portfolios and said, well, what are we going to do with all this valid real estate? I know, let's rent it. Here's a great chemical formulator. So as a result, if they rolled over and played nice on this one, they're opening the door to claims literally in thousands of sites around the country. It is really existential litigation in their perspective. So, 9%, because the trial judge had to make it out of thin air, because BNSF wasn't enough. We're not liable to go any farther. The United States basically said, they're not raising it, we're not going to argue for it. So he had created out of nothing. So do you recall just roughly the factors he threw out of thin air? You don't have to give me specific numbers, just general categories.
It was like 2/3 of the chemicals, they were only
Remember, three chemicals, but only two made it, were handled over here. They have just this slice. And also duration, do you remember that?
And they were only the owner for 15 out of the 40 or 30
right. years. So you take all those sub percentages, multiply them together, and it comes out to a little less than 6%.
And to give you a sense of the precision of this calculation, the court basically said, just to fudge it up, we'll add 50% back on top of that to make sure everyone's protected. With 9%. Shazam, we're done. The circuit court said, we don't think so. The Supreme Court said, that's just fine. So here's a quick question, and I'll see if we can do this in the last few minutes of class before we wrap up. Why did Justice Stevens, one of the most pro-environmental Supreme Court justices we've ever had, the man who wrote the Maskeen EPA, conclude that the rail line company was not joining some reliable with the Superman statute? What was the magic ingredient? And by the way, as you're thinking about it, let me share with you what the book doesn't tell you. Every single environmental lawyer worth her or his salt would have told you that this was joint several line work. It was overwhelming the case that every single Superfund site was joint several line work. I can count on one hand the number of cases prior to this one where a circuit court held that there was severability, and usually very extreme facts. So what did Justice Stevens say that led to the hearing? Let me back up a step. Does that strike you as the right answer? Why not?
I just put all the bases for it. I mean, I get the time and I guess surface area contributed like as a way to see who did what. That 2/3 of the chemicals that caused the contamination, that just seems like honestly random and not helpful at all.
Sorry, I'm trying to hear this.
Talks about a reasonable basis to just say, oh, Divya, based on who owned the lands, that doesn't seem to be
so. It seems kind of ad hoc.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Seems like he was making it on his own mind.
Which is ironic because every other court would take the same approach previously to say the result here should be the reading of person statute. And that we should interpret it to cast Michael as broadly as possible. Get all the resources to the table we need. The short answer is, and I asked you a bit of an unfair question, he went back to first principles, section 433A of the restatement second of courts, which by that point was like 40 years old, this decision. He just basically said, it's all you need is a reasonable basis, quote unquote, and define reasonable to include these factors. That's it. So, what does that mean? It means that we are still sorting out the damage, sorting out how to apply this case in the practice area. Because what's reasonable? The court doesn't really give you hard guidelines. So we have some courts saying basically duration of ownership is just fine. We have other courts saying you need a lot more and a lot more precision. I will simply say, as long as you're negotiating on behalf of your client, you just simply have to find good objective bases that don't require subjective evaluation of the status of materials to argue why your percentage is lower than someone else's. Let me add one other final grace note. I'm a little over 7 o'clock, but we're close. How do I say this? You can have a very tough negotiation with United States. You can have a very hard-fought negotiation with people suing you for money. But the worst negotiation you can have is arguing with your fellow PRPs about whose share is bigger than the others. Usually what we will do, if we're in that sort of group, is we just say, BOSCO, volume, that's all. If you send 1,000,000 gallons and I send 500,000 gallons, pay twice as much as they were done. And it doesn't matter what those gallons are. What happens though is under this, when you're looking for a reasonable basis, you start worrying about things like toxicity. start worrying about things like when the waste got there. You start worrying about which part of the site the waste got put off. I was at one site in California where we actually had to hire a scientific consultant who came up with a formula with multivariate calculus to figure out who everybody's respective share was going to be based on this particular site. It's incredibly contentious and complicated. But bottom line is, that's the door opened by this decision. And by the way, that there's probably some more personal thing that I meant to inject. But nonetheless, I think it's a realistic assessment of the challenges of implementing this decision. So with that, any questions about the machine, the liability of the machine, the acceptance for it, owner, operator, arrangements and transporters, and the bases for joint several liability, the allocation? It's all sort of at least roughly fit together so far. Because next Monday, back we've done interpretation. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask all of you to assume a role for a Superfund negotiation, which will take place Wednesday. I want to give you a heads up on what it is, so just to think about it during class on Monday. The idea is I'm going to ask you to basically represent large PRPs, site owners, transporters, and first time ever I've done this, I'm going to ask another party persons in the class to represent the EPA and the state. Usually I play EPA. What I'd like to do instead is the supervising attorney EPA and let the junior attorney EPA actually handle negotiations with you. Now, your challenge is going to figure out how to split up a settlement negotiation so that you can actually reach a total amount that will let you clean up the site. Otherwise, I'm going to issue the 106 orders. That's what EPA is going to issue. So, with that in mind, what we're going to talk about on Monday is allocation versus. Visibility. So, basically, notice that here's why. I'm just going to mention this very quickly. There's a footnote in here in the case that talks about the fact that you don't look at equitable factors for allocation purposes, for visibility purposes. What we're going to talk about is there's a difference between divvying up who's liable for joint several liability purposes, so it's only several liability, as opposed to when everybody's joint several, how do you split up that pie everyone has to share? Equity is all about the second. It doesn't play a role at all in the first. The first is strictly factor. So keep that in mind. With that, last chance for candy, questions. Hopefully the waters have gone down the roads, not down, you can get home. Actually, they're actually keeping class here for Happy holidays, everybody.
Good.
Real quickly. Okay. There we go. I've discovered that I don't get a recording unless I sign out. So I need to do that part. Okay.
I talked to Professor Hurd.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
About that. And he said it would actually be So I will forward you the application for that so you can
for the clinic.
Yes, for the clinic. Yeah. And just I guess some parameters for how the clinic usually handles things. It does take a while for the student attorney to handle it. So that's something to keep in mind.
Okay. No problem.
Right. And in addition to that, after you fill out the application, you sort of review it as a class and then see if that's something the clinic wants to take on. But initially, you can ask Professor Hurd.
Do you have a sense of when they'll review the case?
If you submit it, I'm sure we'll submit it, we'll review it next class, which is next Tuesday. So
yeah, if you can get it to me, I'll get it to you before next Tuesday.
Sure, yeah, I can send you that link and then some additional information.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah,
thank you. And of course, you guys, this means you have to fly to Suriname to protect the jaguars.
That would be pretty cool.
No, pass the bar first.
Right.
Pass the bar first.
Of course, after that.
Okay.
I don't know if you watched Doctor Who, but the most recent episode was about dumping toxic waste.
Oh, really?
And like building upon land that was there's like a toxic waste company and they try to repurpose the land. Wow. And it's all about that.
Okay. I need to see the new doctor anyway. So
it's the fourth episode, but they go into like there's labs involved and the toxic waste from a lab and not knowing where that goes, but it's all, I was like, wow, this is currently.
So you realize there's a small risk I might find a final exam question after that episode.
I think we could confuse anyone else in this class.
Dalek Corporation has.
But it's, because it's from London, so I don't know how the law, like this.